Hey, Sens fans, this is Stuntman Stu, and you're listening to the Sixth Sense Podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of the Sixth Sense Podcast. It is helmet day in the nation's capital, and Tim and Francois are going to be passing a mic around because the headphones in the other studio aren't working properly.
Yeah, that's the reason behind that.
So how are you guys doing?
Just fine. Still pretty amped up from the draft combine that just finished up this week.
Yeah, I'm doing all right as well. Been watching a lot of the LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, Dirk Nowitzki NBA Finals extravaganza, and the draft combine just blew me away, especially Sean Couturier's performance. I told Tim before I came in the studio I wanted to be the one to lead that rant, but I mean, come on, three reps at 150 pounds, the guy's listed at 195. That means is one. I mean, even for the everyday average, everyone theoretically you should be able to lift your own weight once. So I calculated that the one rep max of three reps at 150 before coming here, and it translates to one rep max of 159. And this is a guy who's supposed to be close to pro level conditioning, cannot even press his own weight once. So,
but isn't that the big concern? Because like Huberto, if we're talking NHL scouting combines, Huberto, who's been playing almost 90 games of hockey over the past season. And this is a kid who did, two reps? And then Couturier has been off for 2 months after getting eliminated in the Q playoffs. And he could only do three. And he's significantly larger. Is that a red flag on his conditioning and, like, how dedicated he is for, like, his off-ice training?
I don't know if it's a red flag. It just means that he's simply not strong enough yet to compete in the NHL. Like, how many NHL athletes do you think show up at their first training camp only being able to, you know, bench press 150 pounds two or three times? Like, how often does that happen?
I think Danny Heatley might have done that a couple of times. Big guy, but you can see there's just no muscle there whatsoever. I don't know. It's the NHL Combine, I think it's... You know,
well, it's a marketing thing, right?
It's total is. Marketing thing. It's Gary Bettman bullshit. They're trying to, I guess, sort of piggyback off that whole NFL draft combine concept. But I mean, the NFL just in general is an entirely different beast altogether. And I think,
when the kicker David Buehler from USC was he kicked up 225, 26 times, freakish shit.
Yeah.
They're not doing like leg press, which is probably something that would be conducive to the kind of like exercise that they're always doing during the off season, right?
Or squats or side lunges or something more representative of, you know, you can see why in the NFL combine they would test the bench press because it's a staple exercise for any football conditioning program, not only to build mass in the upper body, but I mean, if you look at blocking and whatnot, I mean, that motion is very akin to the bench press motion. So it's no surprise that they would test to see what someone's power is, especially offensive linemen and other offensive players. The combine format for the NHL, or at least as it is, the various exercises maybe don't necessarily match up with adding any value from a projectability standpoint, at least I think.
Well, have a sip of your protein shake and pass the mic to Tim.
Yeah, one of the problems I have with the with this combine is you get a guy like Huberto, right? And he shows up and he, you know, was able to do it two lifts on the bench press, and that's fine. But then he gets all these accolades for even showing up and doing the physical testing because he finished the Memorial Cup like last week. Well, you know, that's fantastic. And they're talking about Taylor Hall and how he bailed on it last year. I mean, if it doesn't matter at all, if it just counts that you show up and throw up, then, you know, what's the point of it? All these scouts are talking about how it's not really a big deal for them. They kind of know what they know. Leading up to this point, we know the Senators already had their draft meetings and their draft list is, you know, pretty much as close to good to go as it gets. So what's the point of this combine if guys are going to show up, embarrass themselves as being physical specimens, as, you know, late teenagers, soon to be professional athletes, and the television is terrible. Like, we got to listen to that meathead on TSN who doesn't blink and doesn't wear a shirt.
He's wearing a fleece. He's wearing like a fleece type jacket with no undershirt underneath it.
Yeah, like a half zip performance fleece with no t-shirt. Like, what are you doing to yourself? You're not even there to work out. Like, you couldn't have thrown on a dirty suit. And unbelievable. But yeah, I just don't understand it. Like, it's bad TV. There's bad performances, and then they have the nerve to talk about, you know, the winners and the losers of the combine. Like, I don't really know. Beats me.
I just look at the combine as an opportunity for organizations to go there, engage how dedicated these players who may have been off for a significantly long period of time, like 2-3 months, if they didn't make their playoffs. And if guys are underwhelming and they show up out of shape to something that's that significant, I just kind of view that as you can almost like dismiss a kid's dedication.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of surprised. I mean, I think if I was an agent, especially for a guy who was like slotted to be a top 10 pick, I'd tell him not to go. Because any little thing that could affect his draft stock, especially we're seeing like Huberto put up 2 reps on the bench press and Couturier put up 3 reps on the bench press. I mean, you can make excuses forever for these guys. Oh, well, he's extended playoff run. I'm sorry, you know, 2 reps at 150 pounds is not impressive by anybody's standards. I don't care if the guy's a 17-year-old kid. I mean, he's supposed to have a professional athlete-level conditioning, which would mean he should be able to do more than that. So to me, even though the scouts say, yeah, it doesn't matter and it doesn't really matter, we've seen them all and stuff like that. I mean, if I was an agent of one of these players, especially one that was slotted to go top 5, top 10, I would tell him not to go. Because, I mean, if the scouts have seen everything, why would you risk affecting your player's draft stock out of him embarrassing himself at the draft combine? You know, we saw Huberto wearing a sleeveless shirt talking to Gordon Miller. I mean, you saw the size of those pipes on him. Like, that's not helping him out at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's pretty safe to say that the mic I'm holding is denser than Huberto's arms. But it's interesting, though. Like, these guys can have success in, you know, what's considered to be the building block to playing in a man's league. And in many cases, these guys are playing against some men, like some of the overagers in junior. But and they're still able to have success. So what's interesting is you see a guy like, I actually saw Bertuzzi doing an interview without a shirt on YouTube a while ago. And, you know, he's a big guy. Like, he's, you know, has a man's body. And it's interesting to, you know, project what a guy like Huberto is going to be able to play like when he, in fact, you know, grows into, you know, a body comparable to that of a man in the NHL. It's adds a whole new dimension for the scout.
When you were looking at Bertuzzi, were you thinking, like, I don't want that guy on me. If my head hits the ice, I'm fucked.
Yeah, he's got a lot of body hair, you know?
I was going for the whole, like, Dominic Moore parallel.
Yeah, I remember that. I vaguely recall that incident.
Oh,
from what I can remember, Mark Crawford snickered and Marcus Naslund had justice served.
No, Tim, I believe you misremember the incident.
Shying away from the combine talk. Even, I know how much you guys want to talk about.
Let's talk combine. Come on, let's continue talking combine.
Yeah,
let's just do an all combine edition of the podcast and see how much dead air we can keep filling with combine talk. No, take it where you want to go.
Are you guys surprised though that there haven't been like any outlandish like freak stories where hey, this 6'7" defenseman showed up, like Oleksiak, for example, doesn't show up and like just put on a clinic and just school some of these guys who will only kick it out like 2-3 reps.
Yeah, that's weird because like at the NFL combine you always hear these guys show up and put on these like who was it? Peterson, the DB, just showed up and just did this freakish stuff, and Julio Jones ran a 4.4 on a broken foot that he didn't even know was broken until after he ran his 40. I mean, you're right. We're not seeing any of these like compelling stories come out of the NHL combine. So it's kind of strange, I guess, in a way. Like,
the big thing that I wonder about is I didn't watch the actual TSN programming, just the highlights of it. And, you know, I heard Bob McKenzie and some of these other guys talking about how Landeskog was built like a shithouse or whatever term it was that they, you know, didn't refer to as shithouse, but a big guy. And I see him, and he's got the body of, like, you know, a juvenile soccer player, it looks like. You know, these guys aren't nearly as, you know, ripped as I expect them. Like, I don't know, Francois, what's the, you know, like the physical capacity of an 18-year-old for putting on muscle? Like, is it really as, you know, hard to do as some of these kids are making it out to be?
Well, I mean, in my opinion, obviously, like, 18-year-old won't produce sort of the testosterone that someone, and maybe it's unfair to compare them to a lot of these U.S. college football players that are coming out of college, because a lot of these guys are coming out at 21, 22 years old. And oftentimes, you know, in that the 20 to 22 age range, you know, that's when you really start producing more testosterone and other things like that, and really start to develop that man strength that allows you to put on the muscle. But I do find it surprising, though, that it's not necessarily from like a muscle building standpoint, but I do find it surprising that some of these guys who... I think it's just more from a conditioning standpoint, like a strength standpoint. I can get that someone doesn't look like an athlete yet because he's 18, but from a strength standpoint, I would have expected more from some of these guys, at least. I mean, you look at high school football and basketball players and stuff like that, and a lot of them are, their conditioning you'd think is significantly better than some of these guys. I don't know.
Those kids have like short seasons though, right? Like by comparative standards, like after an 80 game season, like you lose a lot of your like mass muscle.
Yeah, but how many push-ups did we see Huberto account for there? What was it?
26.
Yeah, like that's, I mean, even in practice and stuff, when you botch a play or, you know, when the coach decides to penalize you by doing some push-ups on the ice, you're telling me these guys are buckling after doing 26? Like, have you seen Full Metal Jacket? How many push-ups, like, you know, a young kid in a comparable situation should be able to turn out? Like, those are military expectations. Sure enough, they're pretty similar to that of the NHL.
I'd like to see you kick at 26 push-ups right now.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Later. I'm wearing flip-flops, and I don't want to have my bare feet on this disgusting rug. I'll tell you what, I'll do them on Francois's back.
So, from junior prospects to junior coaches, what is up with Dave Cameron?
Has there been a guy who's had a worse year in hockey expecting a major promotion than Dave Cameron?
He's got the loyalty card working for him, though, right? That's the kicker, right? He's got Melnick has his back. Like, I wouldn't write it off. It wouldn't surprise me. I think that guy's in line for perhaps an assistant coaching position with the Senators. That wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. I mean, you called him a junior coach. I call him more of an amateur coach. Given the debauchery that the Ottawa Senators coaching position has become, I mean, the last thing I think... anyone who followed the junior game and who's seen what a disaster Dave Cameron's year has been, I think the last thing we would want is for Dave Cameron to be the head coach of this team. I mean, the guy can only coach two goddamn periods. Like, but I could see it happening, though. I guess so jaded from, like, the Melnick wanting to grab the headlines and stuff like that. Like, you could see it. I could see it happening where, like, Melnick, you know, hook a brother up.
Are you guys a little bit surprised that we haven't heard the name of Pete DeBoer kicked around that often? Because that's a guy who, what, 3 years ago was in strong consideration for the Ottawa position. He went down to Barbados, visited Melnick. We don't know what happened. Maybe they didn't like the figures that were exchanged. Maybe Melnick got a bad vibe and then decided to go with Hartsburg. We don't really know. But now that guy has NHL experience and he took kind of like a crappy Panthers team to like the verge of like the brink of the playoffs, I'm just surprised that guy isn't getting or receiving some, like, stronger consideration from the organization.
Yeah, like I'm very surprised actually. To me personally, Peter DeBoer would actually probably be close to the top of my list actually. Not only given the fact that it's kind of strange to see the first time around he was considered and he came awfully close to getting the coaching position the first time around, but it's like you say. I mean, he took a marginal Florida Panthers team to the brink of the playoffs, a team that really did not have a top elite top center, and I mean Bullmeister. I think the jury's still out on whether he's top defenseman or not. Like Babcock flamed out his first time around in Anaheim, maybe because it's just he had to sort of go to school of hard knocks. But I see for some reason that just intuitively, DeBoer strikes me as a Babcock type of guy. So I'm kind of surprised they're not considering him. I don't know. What do you think, Tim?
I'm more interested in the type of guy that they're looking for this position. I think DeBoer would be an interesting idea. Mind you, he had some success, relative success, with the tools that he had in Florida and trying to make the best of that situation. But I've been watching Oil Change recently, and when you see the way Tom Rennie handles the young kids and, you know, kind of, you know, brings to mind the way Clydendorst in Bingo handles those guys as well. Like, lots of positive reinforcement, serious accountability, you know, on the way to being, you know, kind of a player's coach-y kind of guy, but still with that, you know, hard fist attitude and willingness to to call people out, and as well to praise others. And I think that that's really important that the Senators get this right. They get a good, solid communicator. If that was the problem with Clouston, then it's got to be, you know, you got to be sure as hell that you're bringing in a guy who the young players are going to be able to learn from and respect, as well as appeasing the vets. And I don't know if DeBoer is a guy that's necessarily going to, you know, generate a lot of respect from some of these guys in the dressing room who maybe are a little bit difficult to handle.
Here are some of the names that are on the list of people being considered. We have Paul McLean, the assistant head coach in Detroit. We have Kirk Klein endorsed. We have Dave Cameron, Kirk Muller. And to celebrate Helmet Day in the Capitol, Craig McTavish.
Yeah, though, I mean,
I don't know. It's kind of
it's all over the map, eh?
It's sort of underwhelming.
The Kirk Muller actually intrigues me a little bit, but
it's weird though because Muller.
I like the pedigree.
Muller was in Montreal when Guy Carbonneau was there, and Carbo kind of had the same thing going on with Kovalev that Corey Clouston just had, and it's weird to see now he's like a sexy name because he knows how to operate a Montreal power play.
Yeah, and the other thing with Muller is might he come with sort of like that Montreal Canadiens superiority complex, like that whole like Montreal Canadiens, what you know what
that
I mean?
Asshole
like that
vibe.
Exactly, like that whole just because he, I mean, most of his career was spent with the Montreal Canadiens, and now his coaching experiences with the Montreal Canadiens, and like it or not, it's a very storied franchise. I'm sure there's a lot of emotional investment there. There's a huge sense of belonging and pride that goes into when you're a member of that organization. So from that standpoint, like from a, you know, from an organizational culture standpoint, if you will, I just don't know if Kirk Muller would be necessarily the best fit to bring in here. Like if he brings that whole attitude of like, well, the Montreal way of doing things and this and that, you know what I mean? I just don't know how adaptable he might be.
Yeah, certainly. Like the Canadians seem to be like the Ivy League of the NHL, and you know Muller's obviously been fast tracked since he retired from the game to be a head coach, and he's obviously done all the right things so far. Is Ottawa even a place he wants to come to cut his teeth? Is that the kind of job that you want as your first head coaching job? Obviously, head coaching jobs are up for grabs for a reason, right? I mean, I don't think you're going to have people banging on the doors of teams like Minnesota and Florida and Ottawa, just, you know, because this is their dream job to come here and coach a seemingly uninspired, lethargic, young, rebuilding team, right? But I think a guy like Muller, I think the one pro that he really has going for him is the fact that he has credibility around the league. He's the kind of guy that kids would maybe shut up and, you know, sincerely listen to when he's telling them about what it takes to win. You know, he's got cups. That's important.
I almost have like the similar concerns for Paul McLean coming out of Detroit, because that's a program that's so storied. Everybody loves, like, but you know, Detroit, they have Jim Neal. That guy has been rumored for like a GM job in every other organization, but they do not let that guy leave. They don't let the good guys leave. And I kind of worry that like a guy like McLean might be like one of those assistant types that we've seen leave, like the New England Patriots, for example. Like everybody wants like a Belichick disciple. We'll see guys like Eric Mangini go elsewhere and fail miserably, or like Romeo Crennel or
Josh McDaniels.
Charlie Weiss and Josh McDaniels. It's just like
Todd Haley.
Yeah, it's just it's one of those things where I think if you purge an organization from some of that organizational asset talent, you're not necessarily guaranteeing yourself success moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. And I think you're right. Like, Detroit doesn't let the good guys leave. And I think the only reason they let Yzerman leave was because Yzerman is, he is and always will be a Red Wing. And he just wanted that competitive challenge to go and build his own team. And I think it was almost like they were happy to let him go.
And
he realized
that opportunity wasn't going to come quickly because Ken Holland is so entrenched in that position, and he's not going to give that position up anytime soon. Like, he's considered by everyone to be the cream of the crop, the best executive in hockey, and I think he just wanted that challenge. He thought he was ready, and obviously with the success that Tampa's had, he's played a large role in that.
Are you guys actually, and just to continue a little bit, I think McTavish would be a total disaster. Are you guys surprised? Haven't heard the name Ken Hitchcock more? Like, I'm a little bit surprised we haven't heard the Ken Hitchcock name come up a little bit more.
Well, getting back to McTavish, that guy wasn't good enough for the rebuild in Edmonton. He burned himself out getting tired of, like, the rookies and the development. Like, look at what happened with Sam Gagne and Andrew Cogliano. Those guys haven't developed in, like, 4 years. That's a huge red flag for me personally. But, yeah, Hitchcock, I think the concern with Hitchcock is that his shelf life is like a jar of mayonnaise that's been left in the sun on the back of a deck on a nice, warm, hot, sunny day.
Wait, are you still talking about a jar of mayonnaise? You're actually talking about Ken Hitchcock?
Both. It's,
but I mean, the one thing that does intrigue me about Hitchcock, though, and I don't disagree with you about the whole shelf life thing, and I think that is true. Hitchcock seems to have become a fairly big believer in Jason Spezza over the last couple of years, was coaching him at world championships and stuff like that. So that could be an interesting fit, because it seems like a lot of those teams that have success, there is sort of that trust from like the head coach to his star player. You know what I mean? There is that sort of unspoken, like, you're my star player, and like, it's going to be on you to get us through some of these games. And I could be misreading that, but
that's... I wonder if Brian Murray went to him after like the IIHF World Championships over in Slovakia and said, Jason, what do you think of Ken Hitchcock? What do you think of him personally? How did he coach over there? Do you think he'd be a good fit? You know, because like, Spezza is considered to be like probably the next captain of this franchise. It'd be interesting to get his take on like what would be a great fit for the organization right now.
Well, Hitchcock's a veteran guy, right? He likes to go to his vets. I'm sure that the response he got from Jason Spezza now, as he's what, 27? 28 years old is a lot different than the response he would have had about how he felt about Hitchcock at age 22, right? You know, is Hitchcock the kind of guy that you want handling all the young players in Ottawa? Really? I mean...
Well, most of them are defensive prospects, so it's not... Especially in the forward ranks, right? Like, he doesn't have a lot of those one-dimensional talents. Well, on the back end, he does. So that would kind of be a concern. But yeah, that's a good, valid point.
Yeah, there's a little bit of the, you know, of the McTavish worrisomeness. But I am surprised that there aren't some, you know, bigger, more veteran names available or that have been interviewed. Perhaps they have been, and we just haven't heard about it. But that list isn't at all what I expected. I expected validated, professional, winning coaches, not McTavish and Dave Cameron.
I think I would have expected a mix of, like, those household names that sort of come up in the coaching conversations every time, and then the lesser knowns. Not saying I would prefer,
like Kevin Dineen was
like sort of like the first time around, like when we were when we hired Hartsburg, like Tortorella was in the conversation. Some of the more current household names in coaching that have recently been let go or whatever. I would have expected to see a few more of those names in that mentioned in the conversation as well.
Tortorella in Ottawa, though, like, just as an aside, that would have been fucking incredible.
I like Tortorella. I actually think he's quite a good coach.
We're going to get into Larry Brooks a little bit later in the show. But yeah, it's just the way he puts people in their place. If they think he's, you know, if he thinks they're being unreasonable or out of line, then he's good. Like, he sticks up for his guys, and that's fantastic. Even when it's undeserved.
He's got a Stanley Cup to his credit as well.
His team's played great 5-on-5 hockey.
I mean, I like Tortorella. I think Tortorella's a good coach, but obviously he's not an option right now.
So do you want me to go to Larry Brooks right now? Do you want to keep going? All right. Today in the New York Post, there was an article that essentially said, if the New York Rangers fail to land Brad Richards in free agency, if they're unwilling to pay what Richards wants, they might have to go out and start kicking the tires on a bunch of other number one centers who may be available, guys from bad teams. And Jason Spezza's name was brought up. And in the article itself, it said the Rangers are pretty fond of Jason Spezza. So, immediately, just get your thoughts out.
Immediately, I'm surprised that there was tire kicking done and it wasn't Doug Wilson. No way it's going to happen. What are the Rangers going to give up for him? Of course, it's their job to put in that phone call and see what other options are available.
Yeah, exactly. It's just due diligence, yeah.
Yeah, like maybe the money that Brad Richards is looking for is considerably more than what the Senators are paying Spezza. And if that's true, that's really, really, really scary. Number one, that Brad Richards is a 31-year-old who has four good seasons left in him. He's going to get that kind of cash. That's unsettling at best. But I don't think that Spets is going anywhere, just them doing their job.
I think the one thing that's kind of cool as well is with these horrible free agent classes, like the one headlined by Brian Campbell, the one headlined by Brad Richards this year, the Spezza contract actually looks better and better and better with every passing year, both from a cap hit standpoint and from an overall dollar figure standpoint.
I don't think anyone expected the cap to be inflated as much as it as it has. Like, I think after this year, the rumor was it's going up to $63 million.
The floor would be 48, I think.
That's 48 to 50.
And you got a team in Winnipeg that has an arena that holds 15 and a half that's going to have to spend at least $48 million U.S. a year.
But that's,
can you imagine when the Canadian dollar dips? Like, this is ridiculous.
But that's double what the salary cap was immediately after that lockout. It's crazy.
Yeah. It's, I mean, whatever makes Bettman look good, though, right? Like, that's the name of the game. You know, $60 million relocation fee.
He didn't look happy.
And then you can pump that into Phoenix, and you can make, you could tell the governors that everything is A-okay.
He ate some crow, though, in Winnipeg this past week at that press conference. He looked uncomfortable. He looked awkward.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was the quickest fix, right?
And quickest this, fix, obviously, pockets, this. Right?
I mean, apparently there was a rumor that Tom Glavine was trying to get an ownership group together to keep the Thrashers in Atlanta. You know, I think it goes back to a conversation we had a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. I don't think the NHL ever gave Atlanta a fair chance to work out. I mean, you're talking strategically, does not make sense to let that franchise fold instead of Phoenix. You're talking about the sixth biggest television market in the U.S., and you're pulling a hockey team out. And you're trying to get a big, you're trying to work towards improving your television contracts and everything else. Does not make sense from a business standpoint to let the Thrashers fold like that. I mean, he should have pulled up stakes on the Coyotes 2-3 years ago when they were in trouble, but it's only because the idiots in Scottsdale or Glendale or wherever it is are prepared to underwrite the thing. And Atlanta wasn't prepared to start supporting the franchise. And I can't blame them. I mean, I've been there. There are other priorities that probably should be addressed with taxpayer money, not keeping the Thrashers afloat is probably not a priority for the city of Atlanta down there. But,
and what, the league got like a $60 million relocation fee?
Well, that's it.
What the hell is that? That's extortion.
Exactly. So, like, he gets a $60 million relocation fee, and then he can pump that into Phoenix or whatever the hell he has to do. And he looks good. He looks good to the governors or whatever. But realistically, what they should have done was he should have left the Thrashers in Atlanta for another year. You know, the NHL should have taken over ownership of the Thrashers for a year and figured it out better. They have a building in Seattle that can hold 19,000. It's decrepit as shit. But, I mean, at least they could have thrown a franchise in there for a couple of years until they got a proper building built up. And I think Seattle's a way more viable market than Winnipeg, especially when you take into consideration, I mean, I've beaten this horse to death, I know, but especially when you take into consideration that the Canadian dollar is not going to stay as high as it is at perpetuity, and no one's going to want to go play in Winnipeg, and people are mortgaging their house for season tickets in Winnipeg, so.
Without getting into it too much, I mean, you could make the argument that Western Canada, like the prairies, are kind of, you know, some of the, you know, the cities on the rise in Canada, like Winnipeg and Regina, are doing great things.
Nothing's rising in Regina.
That's so uneducated, Graham. You couldn't be further misinformed about the state of Regina and Saskatchewan. But, you know, it's worth a shot. The size of that stadium is just, that's going to worry a lot of people for a long time, and it should, especially when, you know, year four rolls around and you start seeing, you know, maybe the season ticket renewals aren't coming in as feverishly as they recently have been. That's when you're going to start to have concern, and you're not going to be able to hold anyone as soon as they get to UFA status. I mean, who in their right mind is going to want to live in Winnipeg by choice at age 28, settling down with a family in Winnipeg?
But that's the problem, right? It's that whole situation that's very cyclical where they've come out, they've said all the right things. We're going to draft, develop properly. We're not going to go splurge in free agency, and we're going to build a system, make sure it's deep, and then worry about it. The problem is you get into situations where you have your core players, you identify your core players, but you have to overpay to keep those core players in town. And that's kind of what happened in Ottawa, right? Like, guys like Mike Fisher and like some of the other guys were slightly overpaid to stay in town because it is an Ottawa city and you have to like overpay to keep some of these guys.
But I think in the case of Winnipeg, like, it's probably worse.
Yeah. Look at Sean Horkoff in Edmonton. Like, that guy's getting like $5 million.
Yeah, and Edmonton has enough problems as is, and I think Winnipeg is like worse, you know? And this is not like social commentary on the city of Winnipeg. I just think it's the reality. Like, Jonathan Toews was popping off about what a privilege it would be for some of these players to go play in Winnipeg because they'd be so important, blah, 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 blah. Do you think that guy is going to sign in Winnipeg when his deal's up with the Hawks? Like, there's no chance in hell he's going to go there. These guys have been playing in the southern U.S. They're playing. I mean, they have summer weather 365 days a year. If I was a Thrashers player right now and I had to move to Winnipeg, I'd have my agent blowing up whoever the GM's phone is going to be asking for a trade. Or I'd ask to be bought out. I would not want to play in Winnipeg. Like, Andrew Ladd was renegotiating a contract, I think, with the Thrashers, and the whole thing came up. Like, I could see that guy not wanting to re-sign with them now. I can see any number of those guys, especially the American guys, Blake Wheeler, Bogosian, all those. Eventually, those guys. I mean, come on.
All right, so we've been talking about Winnipeg for the last little bit. Coming on after the break is going to be James Gordon, the beat reporter for the Senators. He's from Winnipeg. We'll get the vibe to see how he's feeling, whether he's excited or not. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Just one more drink and then I should be on my way home. I'm not entirely sure what you're talking about. I've had a really nice time, but my dogs need to be fed. I must say that in the right light, you look like Shackleton.
All right, listeners, we're joined on the line right now by the Ottawa Citizens, James Gordon. James, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Not too bad. Not too bad, thanks.
Yeah, good. Not too bad considering first early weeks of summer.
So, James, are you excited by the return of your Winnipeg franchise to the NHL?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I've only been waiting 15 years. So, yeah, I mean, I was one of the lone holdouts that I know of anyways who still had to a genuine belief that this could possibly happen one day. So, yeah, I'm completely thrilled. And, you know, I know you guys came close here to losing a franchise, and be glad you didn't, because it's pretty depressing.
No, we remind ourselves of that every single day. Now, for the listeners, can you give us a brief summary of your ties to the city of Winnipeg and what the Jets have meant to you?
Well, I was born there and grew up there and was there till I was 18, and I came here to go to school, journalism school, and then wound up following the Senators a bit when I came here. I was a big Jet fan from about the time I started playing hockey, which was, I don't know, maybe 8 or something, and then went through all the excitement of Timu Solani setting rookie records and the Solani Kachuk Zhamnov line, which was, you know, one of the tops in the NHL at the time, and the exploits of a young Nikolai Habibulin. So, I followed it really closely, and I'm glad that the people in that city are going to get the chance to do the same with the new team.
How often do you get to go back to Winnipeg, and how much change have you seen in that city since the Jets have departed? And do you think that that the current conditions in Winnipeg are enough for the team to be able to succeed this go-around?
I get back to Winnipeg a little less than I used to because hockey kind of takes over your life a bit when you cover it. So I haven't been able to get back during the season much, but I go back occasionally still, and it's changed a lot. I mean, you can see the development in housing and in the new arena, obviously, and the new baseball stadium. And it just seems like, you know, like Winnipeg kind of hit a rock bottom, I'd say, when the Jets left. I mean, it was really run down. There wasn't a very positive outlook, I guess, for the city. Economy wasn't doing great. And then, you know, just as a final kick in the nads, your hockey team leaves. So they kind of, like say with a lot of problems, you hit rock bottom before you turn it around. And Winnipeg really did after that. I think there's a lot more positivity in that city. And it's a city that kind of weathered the recession pretty well compared to comparable size places. And in terms of supporting the team, the numbers speak for themselves. They sold out their 13,000 within a few days and sold all the tickets that were available to the public in like an hour. So there was obviously a real passion for the team there, and people were willing to step up with their money. And I wasn't surprised about that. And, it's also kind of a take that Gary Bettman, because, you know, I think a lot of Winnipeggers kind of enjoyed that press conference where he gave that backhanded welcome to the NHL, because it's kind of like, we kind of enjoy that you dislike this so much. So.
James, there's been a lot of buzz around the drive to 13. I believe that was the official title that they used. Um, What does this mean for other prospective hockey cities around North America, not just in Canada, like a Quebec City, but earlier this morning, actually, I saw a tweet by someone who's affiliated with the Hartford owner, like the Hartford ownership group, who were interested in bringing a team back there. So what does that mean for teams in that situation?
Well, I mean, it sets a high bar because, you know, Mark Chipman and his team and David Thompson, this wasn't a throw this together in a year because we're excited about hockey and we're going to have taxpayers build a big arena and blah, 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 and get in while the getting's good. I mean, they've been kind of planning this for 10 years, right down to getting the Moose and running that franchise really well. And, you know, there was a bit of a hiccup there for outside observers because when they built the MTS Center at 15,000, I know myself, I was a little put out by that because I thought, oh, great, we're never going to get a team now because the rink's too small. But, you know, they laid the groundwork to be in a position when the economics changed to be able to jump on it. So if you get another prospective team, you know, maybe they'll look at this and start trying to promise the same thing. And I don't know if you'd have trouble getting that many in Quebec City. I can't speak to that, but it definitely sets a high bar for any other team. And it shows that Winnipeg is going to be a reliable revenue generator for the league. So everybody's happy, and right, it sets a good precedent.
James, do you think this officially move to Winnipeg officially marks kind of the slow death of hockey in the South? Obviously, with the problems that they've had in Phoenix, a lot of people are suggesting that's only a matter of time before they are relocated to a more traditional northern market. Do you think this is a little bit of pie in the face for Bettman at this point?
Well, I think it obviously is that for Bettman, and I'd agree with the kind of idea that this is. I think I heard Bruce Arthur refer to it as the canary in the coal mine, because you look at teams like Florida and Columbus and Phoenix and groups like that are just bleeding money. And, I mean, Phoenix would be gone already if it wasn't for the taxpayers in Glendale getting fleeced again by their city council and paying another $25 million to keep a team that nobody wants to watch. So I don't know how long you can sustain that. They took the first $25 million out of the capital fund for, like, utilities equipment and that sort of thing. So I haven't heard where the new $25 million is coming from, but where are they going to find the next $25 million if they can't find an owner? I mean, nobody's really shown up in that market and shown that they're willing to put up the money, their own money, to keep the team there. And as you see teams like Columbus, if it continues that way there, and Florida, you know, you got to be a different kind of person to continue losing $30 million a year and never give up.
James, I wanted to talk to you about Rick Dudley. Obviously, Winnipeg's ownership and management group have an idea for how they want to go about their movement. They want to build from within, not pursue high-profile free agents. Rick Dudley has kind of had a rapport around the league as a great builder of youth. But it seems like he's almost been stigmatized as like a trophy girlfriend kind of GM, where he can stick around in an organization for a year or two, but then he's quickly dismissed. Can you talk about maybe his dismissal as the prospective GM of the new franchise?
Well, it wasn't surprising at all. These guys have done things their own way the whole time, and they have their own group of people who they trust. And the guy they're looking at was well known to them already before this even started. So, you know, if they don't have a relationship with Rick Dudley, why would they bring him along just, you know, because he was already there? I found it pretty hilarious last week that Don Waddell was talking about how, you know, he kind of made it sound like they would want him there, but he wasn't interested in going. And I mean, that was never a possibility. You knew these guys were going to start over fresh, and that's what they're doing. So I expect that to continue.
The one thing that seems to be the most popular source of contention in this whole move is the unnamed team. What do you think the problem is with the Jets? What are some of the motives behind some of the other suggested names like the Moose? And ultimately, what do you think will happen with the name?
My opinion's kind of changing on it, because when they first got the team back, I thought, no way in hell they're calling them the Jets, even though that's what everybody wanted. Because I was just reading up a little bit from some of the writers for the Free Press, and they were saying covering games there was almost like the Jets and the NHL were a dirty word in the press box, because they just didn't want to be associated with with that. They want their new friends, want to be successful, and they didn't want the focus to be on the Jets. They wanted it on the Moose, despite the fact that a lot of people went to Moose games and wearing Jets gear every game. But so I think, and I didn't think they were going to call it the Moose either, because you can't just really flip up a team in a league and not, you know, rebrand it or whatever. But, you know, obviously they wanted, and you got some of that from the comments early on when they were talking about the name. You know, Jets would be okay, but we have to think about it, blah, blah, blah. You could tell they wanted to go a different way, but as this sort of thing has grown and they got the team, and there's a real push in Winnipeg from a lot of people to call it the Jets. You look at Twitter campaigns and petition campaigns and letter writing campaigns, and any poll you read on a Winnipeg newspaper site or anything like that, it's over 60% who want the Jets name back, and with good reason. A lot of people who have a real attachment to NHL hockey in that city were kind of in my age range. So say, you know, age, I don't know, 8 to 20, who are the kind of demographic you'd think you would want for a team, young males with disposable income now. And they're the ones who have a real emotional attachment to that name. So I think it would be a mistake for them not to go that way. And people wouldn't take it well if they didn't. I mean, they'd get over it, but, you know, there's a clear preference. And I think Mark Chipman or one of the other guys was quoted just yesterday saying, you know, there's a lot of good reasons to use the Jets name now. So I think they might be getting swayed a little bit by seeing just how popular the name is. And I mean, you could see that when they got the team. The streets were full of people wearing Jets stuff for a team that doesn't exist. So there you go.
Yeah, I get the impression that each passing day, the further that the Jets name becomes entrenched in people's heads as, you know, the unofficial name for the team, the harder it's going to be for True North to actually come out and say, yes, we're going to call the team the Polar Bears, not the Jets. I think that's just going to add to the level of disgruntled fan if they do.
And that's a good point. I mean, I've been on the radio talking about this, and I've heard a lot of other programs and people talking about it, and everybody just calls them the Jets, like, even though they're not really called that yet, just because that's how people view them. It's the return of the Jets, so that just adds to the momentum.
Switching gears a little bit, just wanted to ask you a little bit about the Senators. Has it been kind of like a boring off season for you at this point, or like, how are you keeping busy these days?
Well, I cover the Senators most of the year, and then after that I kind of do the whole Citizen website for a while, and then take my holidays a bit because I work literally every day during hockey season. So I've had a bit of time off, and I've had a bit of covering other stuff, other people's jobs at the paper. So yeah, I mean, I've been keeping busy. I haven't been as plugged in as I probably should be with them, but I've been keeping an eye on the AHL playoffs just because I was down there in March, and I was really impressed with the way Kurt Kleinendorf was running that team and the kind of resurgence in that city. Despite the fans who believed it was not going well and really blaming the Murrays for that. But, I mean, you can see the kind of building they've done down there starting to pay off. But, yes, I've been keeping an eye on that. Nothing too serious. And I think it's also setting up for an interesting storyline going forward with what you do with Robin Lehner, because the guy can win a Calder Cup at 19. It looks like his development, which was slowed a little earlier in the season, or some people would argue, has sped up a lot. And, yeah, so there's a lot of interesting stuff to keep an eye on down there.
Yeah, the Lehner situation's almost kind of reminded me of how Carey Price started his career with Montreal.
Well, he showed he could be a winner down there. And, I mean, I don't see them kind of rushing him up and dumping Craig Anderson right away. But, you know, he's showing that he wants to compete for the job, which is a good sign for the team.
Yeah, no kidding. It almost makes that Craig Anderson contract seem a little bit iffy with the you know, extra year or two on it than maybe is required as insurance before Lehner comes up.
Right, and I mean, that's something that I was saying when they traded for Craig Anderson, was they're going to have to overpay him, and they might have to give him more term to keep him here, because this looked like a team before he got here that was not going to be near the playoffs for a few years. And lo and behold, things turned around when he came in, and now they're sort of goalie of the future is playing a lot better. So it changes the dynamic a bit, but I mean, I've always been a big Craig Anderson fan before he got here. I thought he was underrated. I thought he would have been Florida's starter if Thomas Colquhoun wasn't there. And I think he showed that he can be a great goaltender when he was in Colorado. So he appears to be happy here. I don't think he would have signed that contract otherwise. And hopefully now that he's settled, he'll settle in and give the Senators a chance to be in the playoffs, even if maybe that's a little far ahead from, you know, where they're projected to be in terms of what they have on paper. A good goalie can do a lot of great things for a franchise.
Well, as we've seen through this process or this playoff process, teams are inevitably always going to need a goaltender after some shaky outings in the playoffs. So hopefully Ottawa might be able to facilitate a deal in the next couple of years and then graduate Lehner into that starter's role.
And you never know how Anderson's going to be playing then. You know, if he's lights out down the line too, then maybe it isn't as hard to move him as you thought. And if he isn't, then he's another albatross contract that teams have to deal with a lot lately. So they have some experience there.
Yeah, we've got a nice history of that. I think we're all more than willing to stomach an Anderson albatross. That's worth the risk.
I don't know. My opinion is if you're going to overpay, then you may as well do it in the most important position.
Yep, that's a good point.
Yep, absolutely. All right, James, thank you very much. We really appreciated having you on. What should Senators fans be looking for in the Citizen in the coming weeks?
Well, a lot of draft coverage. We're having a little meeting next week to see how to approach that. And, that's the next big step for this franchise and as part of the rebuild process. So keep an eye out.
Awesome. Will do. Well, thanks for joining us on the weekend, James.
All right. No problem.
Enjoy the rest of it. All right. Take care.
Yeah, you too.
What a fantastic interview with James Gordon, guys.
Nice to hear a positive spin about Winnipeg for once, eh?
Yeah.
Buffalo North.
The one thing we forgot to ask him was if he was an unrestricted journalist, free agent, would he be inclined to sign down south, or would he actually go back to Winnipeg?
Again, it'd have to be an inflated salary to go to Winnipeg.
If Solani retires for opening game, he should skate around the rink throwing his gloves and shooting them. That's how it should open. Anything less than that is unacceptable.
I think that'd be all right. I'd like to see a Jets reunion for opening night.
Well, Keith Tkachuk said, yeah, he was going to show up on opening night.
Wonder if he'll buy season's tickets.
Happy Boolin's still playing.
Yeah, that's weird.
I don't know what Alexei Zhamnov's doing. So you could get some weird players out there, like Frederick Olausson.
Tempo.
Maybe like Phil Housley can make an appearance.
Yeah.
Tapo Numino would be good.
Ty Domi played some hockey in Winnipeg too, didn't he?
A little bit, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
For B. Chris King, another one.
Yep.
He's affiliated with the league.
Doan, obviously.
Doan.
Is there anyone else?
I'm trying to think of big name guys. Howard Chuck, obviously.
Yeah. A lot of those guys were garbage eaters, though.
Thomas Steen's still there.
And all the Euros they brought over in the Solani years.
Yeah. Igor Yulinov.
Yep. Oh, he was ugly. Ugly. He had a face like a Essensa. Decent goalie. He was one of the first goalies to wear one of those modern masks, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he switched over from those ugly, like the Prusik.
And then he was dealt for Tim Chevalier. Chevalier stunk. Tabarashi was, yep. Yeah, another one. Good filler. Anyways, great filler. Anyways, when we get back after this break, we're going to be joined on the line by Hockey Prospectus's Corey Pronman to talk a little bit about his affiliations, top 100 draft list, and the questions and methods that we have for him.
Controversial list, the way.
It's different. Yeah, it is. It is slightly different, and I think you'll be surprised at how low some of the names are, like Gabriel Landeskog, Duncan Siemens, and a few others. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. All right, listeners, we're joined on the line right now by Hockey Prospectus's Corey Pronman. Corey, how are you?
Doing fine. How about yourself?
Not too bad, thanks. So, Corey, maybe you could tell the listeners about your website and what you do.
Sure thing. Well, Hockey Prospectus mainly is a website devoted to the advanced statistical analysis of hockey. But my role there actually is the prospect expert. I cover every major draft prospect in basically this year, next year, et cetera, et cetera. And I cover mainly every major prospect across all the NHL organizations. And that's basically it. Just write about how they're doing major tournaments, how their development are going, et cetera, et cetera.
Corey, one thing I'd like to ask you about right off the bat is the methodology to your rankings, to the top 100 that you just released. Can you tell us and the listeners a little bit about how you reached some of these conclusions before we start asking about specific players?
Well, one thing that I did that was kind of different than what most people do is I did kind of a market-based analysis to how I did my rankings. If you guys ever read Behind the Net, where Desjardins writes, or just any of the major statistical analysis people on the internet, you'll see that one of the most major influences in terms of hockey analysis has been that possession is the major and most overwhelming trait that a player needs to be successful in the NHL. Basically, just being able to control the puck, keep it out of your end, keep it in their end as much as possible. And with that knowledge, I kind of applied that to forming a prospect rankings. And actually, I wouldn't say like this is a kind of a new concept. There are NHL teams that do evaluate upon these kind of principles, maybe not in such a precise numerical fashion, but there are, I don't want to say names, but there are a couple of NHL teams that draft with a heavy emphasis on possession skills. And that's basically what I looked for when I was trying to do this, was who controls the puck, who doesn't turn it over, who keeps it in the opponent's end a lot. Those are the kind of players that, hopefully, I think are the most valuable to a hockey team. And with that in mind, those are the kind of players that I placed emphasis on when I was doing my draft rank.
And how do these rankings fare in terms of player projection?
Well, I didn't really look at doing these rankings based on who would be the best player tomorrow. If we did it like who's the best player tomorrow, I probably would say Gabriel Landeskog is the best player tomorrow. Because most of these kids are very underdeveloped size-wise, probably don't have complete refined all-around games. And really the rankings are based on who's going to be the best player in about 5 years from now or whatnot. Who's going to be the best player in their peak? That's what I really base this around. Because most of these players are going to take a couple of years before they're even in the NHL, never mind at their peak development. So this was a largely future-based talent influence evaluation, not based on present-day value or immediate impact.
Looking at your rankings, a few names stand out. Obviously, you mentioned Landeskog has slid a little bit. I look at another prospect who's more of a defensive defenseman in Duncan Siemens. Do you place significantly less value on defensively inclined players as opposed to players with high offensive ceilings who control the puck more?
No, actually, there are a couple of defensemen that I place unusually high that are pretty much defensemen. Zakhar Demasyev sticks out there, Albert Yarulin. But the reason why I have Duncan Siemens that low is not because, one, based on what I've seen, based on scouts I've talked to, there are definitely holes in his defensive game. It's not that the thing about Duncan Siemens is his value is driven by his athleticism, or basically what I would call athletic tools, his size, how well he moves around, frame. Those are the things that drive his value. But in terms of how well he controls the puck, how well he moves it, how much keeps it out of his end, how much keeps it in the opponent's end, he doesn't really do that at a significant level. And because of that, I don't like him as much as others do. He's a big guy who moves very well for a guy his size. But aside from that, I really don't see enough in the package there that makes me think he's going to be able to log significant minutes without a major jump in one of those other builds.
All right, Corey. I've got a question about the Senators. Recently, the Senators' assistant general manager, Tim Murray, came out and said that there was, in fact, one kind of like a doomsday scenario where there was one situation that they didn't like happening, picks 1 through 5, and which would ultimately dictate their position at 6. What do you think maybe this scenario would be, maybe the one player that they hope doesn't slide to them? And also, what would you recommend for the Ottawa Senators considering their position in the draft this year?
Well, I know the Senators, based on just from what I've heard and based on their draft history, the Senators are a heavy, talent-based drafting strategy, and it's fortunate they've been one of the better drafting teams over the last couple of years. So, I mean, the one player I see they might want to get to him is Ryan Murphy, just because of the humongous risk factor that Murphy encompasses. And just based on the fact that they don't even want Landeskog falling down to them, just because based on the fact that they usually are a team that favors upside, he is a consensus lottery pick and a guy who a lot of people are going to like, but I'm not sure if they're going to be completely sold on him if he gets all the way down to their spot, just because he doesn't really fit into the mantra that they usually go after in a player.
It's funny that you mentioned Landeskog in that manner, because here in Ottawa, everyone kind of, they look at him in the same vision as they see Alfredsson at the tail end of his career, and they see Landeskog as like an heir apparent Swedish captain who could help fill that role maybe someday down the line. I'm really interested to hear you say that Landeskog might not necessarily be the best selection for Ottawa there.
Well, firstly, it should be stated, like probably as your GM said before, I don't think Landeskog is going to get to six, so I don't think we'll have to worry about that. But comparing Landeskog to Alfredsson, I think, is just not a fair comp, seeing as I don't think he has the kind of offensive upside that Alfredsson had, at least in his peak. Your Landeskog, you're looking probably at a guy who's going to be, he's going to be on a scoring line, he's going to do well, but I don't think he's a guy who's going to be driving a team offensively. And whilst Alfredsson was the captain of the Sens, he was, for a good period of time, one of your best scorers, and I don't think you're going to get that with Landeskog.
Now, recently, one of the stories that emerged out of the NHL Combine, among others, was Sean Couturier putting up an Olympian-esque three reps at 150 pounds on the bench press, which everyone had a good laugh over. Do you put much stock into some of these Combine results, or do you think this is just somewhat of an NHL tactic to make the draft sexier and do something comparable to the NFL Combine?
No, I really don't look at the Combine that much. I mean, I put my rankings up before the Combine even happened, and that really speaks volumes how much I think about it. But the Combine, usually from an NHL scout perspective, the NHL people look at that more as an indication of intangibles rather than an indication of physical strength. They know most of these kids are undeveloped size-wise. Their bodies are still very, very thin. They don't expect them to come in and basically kill all the exercises. But what they do look for is the kid trying? Did he slack off after the season ended and did he just not work out? Is, you know, when they get to the Wingate thing, they look and see, does he muscle through it? Those are they look at. They don't really look at the Combine as a results-based thing.
All right, Corey. Now, I take it you've been following the AHL Calder Cup Finals quite closely. Is this information true?
Quite closely would probably be a little overstated. I've watched it, but I watched those two teams a little bit during the regular season, so I didn't really need to go there to see much, especially since most of the major prospects haven't been playing that much.
All right, so you've been watching the teams over the course of the season. What changes have you seen from the Binghamton Senators, and what's really impressed you? What players have impressed you as that team has grown over the past few months?
Well, again, the problem with right now that I have watching the Binghamton Senators is Weirsiach and Grant weren't playing, so that kind of nothing something wasn't really happy about, just because those are two of the major Senators prospects. Jim O'Brien has been a guy I've been watching a little closely. I think he's been a guy that I don't think he's got major upside, but he's definitely shown indications that he could be ready to push for a spot next year. He's physically grown. I think his defensive game has come to the point where I think he could suffice in a checking role next year. So he's been a guy I've been mildly impressed with. Weirsiach was a guy came the season I had really high expectations for. He did tremendous in the college game. And just based on scouts I've talked to who have watched the Senators and what I've seen, he had a hard year this season. He really had a hard time transitioning from the college game to the professional game. You saw the offensive upside that he had there, but he has a way to go in terms of just understanding all the ins and outs of the defensive game that requires to be a pro, amongst the other things that he just needs to refine. When I saw Derek Grant play in the American Hockey League, he was very impressive. I had followed him playing college at Michigan State, but he's a player I think is very underrated. I would probably even put him in front of Jim O'Brien. I think it's very possible Derek Grant could be a third and possibly even push for a second-line job somewhere in the next couple of years. He's a very well-rounded prospect.
It's weird that you mentioned Derek Grant's name, because you're not the first person that we've had on this show who's praised Derek Grant's game. He hasn't played a lot in the Bingo playoffs. Is that a great depth player for Ottawa moving forward?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. potential why he hasn't played, but usually what happens in this case is he's a college player. He just they're usually accustomed to 30, 40-game seasons, and he just played with Michigan State full year, and then he can't play with Bingo for a couple of games. I would pretty much say he's physically done, and throwing him into a playoff setting, expecting him to perform 100%, was unrealistic. So I really haven't followed him. I don't know if he's injured or not, but I would probably say from assuming that he's a college player, him not playing into June is not going to be alarmed over. But Derek Grant, I think, is a fantastic depth prospect. I think he's really underrated, and I think he's going to be a player for the Senators. Not like a first line or anything, but he's going to be a contributor for the team.
Corey, what have you noticed from the play of Robin Lehner in the playoffs this year? Do you think he might be a candidate to make an earlier jump to the NHL full-time than people anticipated?
Lehner has been fantastic in the playoffs. I think he's been pushing like a 930 save percentage or something. It's very hard analyzing goalies in short samples. Goalies do crazy things in 10 to 15 games. They play well over their talent level, and they play well below. I mean, you just need to look at the performance of NHL goalies over full seasons and watch how they vary up and down to realize it's very hard to get a grasp of goalie prospects. With that in mind, Lehner is one of the better goalie prospects outside of the NHL right now, and if the Senators, I wouldn't say, are very low in that position at the top level, so it's conceivable that he can make a push for the job. He was decent throughout the regular season, and he has the tools where he could make that kind of push. I'm not usually crazy about goalies his age getting a starting job in the NHL, but where the Senators are now goalie-wise in the organization, I think it's conceivable that he could make a push for the job at training camp.
Now, switching back to the draft, could you give us your predictions as to first who you think Ottawa will take with the sixth pick, and if you thought so far as our second first-round pick, who you think maybe a couple players are likely to get drafted in that spot as well?
Again, it depends on how it panned out. The NHL teams, as opposed to other sports, are very close-vested in terms of who they're drafting. I probably could mock you like say a couple of the top couple of picks, but I really can't say for certain who's going to get down to Ottawa at six. Again, based on how they drafted before, if anyone, I believe, of Strom or Huberdeau get down to their spot, I have to think they're going to be looking at both of those players very closely. Those are the kind of players that I think that they would covet. Asking me to go to where a second first round pick is, I can't really help you there. I can't mock all the way down to that spot, and it's a crapshoot once you get out of the top 10 picks in this draft.
If it's such a crapshoot, the follow-up I had for you, is there a player maybe in the top 8 to 15 that you would consider trading up for? Is there a player that you think might be a little bit of a sleeper pick in that range?
I'm not sure about the 8 to 15 range, but I do think Nikita Kucherov, a player who's played in the Russian Junior League, is a guy who I have in my top 20, and I think it's conceivable he's going to fall out of the top 35 to 40. And whoever gets him is going to be getting a player who does have first-line scoring upside. Just the fact that he plays in Russia and hasn't shown a willingness to come over just quite yet, I think it's going to push him way out of that first-round range. But Kucherov is a guy I really like. Scott Mayfield from the United States Hockey League, I think he's probably going to go in the late first. If you get him in the mid first, I think that might be good value there. He's an extremely toolsy defensive prospect, 6'4", 200 guy, moves well, good at the puck. He's a guy just got really underrated because he didn't really put up much in terms of statistics in the United States Hockey League this year. And that would probably be, I think Yaskin is a guy who's kind of underrated, but I don't think he's going to slide that much.
Corey, who do you think is one of the more traditionally overrated prospects that we may see drafted in the top 10 in this year's draft? I mean, maybe some of the similar names that we've seen from ISS or CSS or one of the other independent scouting magazines.
Well, I'm not going to comment on what anyone else has ranked prospects, but I guess based on the consensus of where we had him, like I said before, I'm not a Landis Cogliker. I think he's a great prospect at what he does. I mean, he's a big guy, moves very well, works his tail off, has decent shot, great in the physical game. And if you're looking for a big guy who's going to run around, play good defense, and be a good two-way power forward, that's your guy right there. And I think he's going to be great at what he does. But in terms of doing the thing that is most important to winning hockey games, which is controlling the possession and controlling the puck, I don't think Landeskog is good at that. And because of that, I think he's not going to be giving the value that you want out of a player who's going to go in the top 5 or 10. And that's why I wouldn't have him in that range.
Yeah, it's interesting because we are of the mindset that you really shouldn't be, you know, drafting intangibles over, you know, offensive potential that high in the first round. So it's just interesting to see someone else, you know, actually formulate that opinion.
Yeah, and I don't really think he doesn't have offensive potential, but he has some. But it's not that his intangibles, I think, are overrated. Is that the package of skills he's bringing are not something that are going to be a significant value both ways over the course of the entire season. I think he can still score, and I think his intangibles are going to be useful defensively. But when you draft in the top 10, you want someone who's going to be doing great things, not just good things. And I just don't see Landeskog fitting that description.
Sean Couturier is a prospect who's kind of slid in a few other rankings, but you still have Couturier ranked fairly high. What do you attribute to Couturier's slide?
Based on what I've been hearing, Couturier has slid in the mainstream consensus just because that's usually the case that happens with late 92 birth dates or just late birth dates in any draft class. It's the old mantra, scouts see people too long, they pick their game apart. It happens all the time in every draft year. You can just go back to, you know, when the Tavares draft year came along, as him and Hedman both had their games analyzed to no end. Any time you have someone who's a late birthday top prospect, they just get completely overanalyzed. And when I look at late birthdays, I try to be objective. When I'm looking at them, I know some other teams have a philosophy. I try not to look at this guy too much, and I try not to look at him too little. I think I know one team that's done very well in the NHL the past couple of years actually have like a games play limit they have when it comes to scouting prospects. They don't want to see a certain guy more than a certain amount of times before they get drafted, so they don't become biased in their opinion. And in my opinion, Sean Couturier has one flaw. He's not a great skater. Everybody knows who's been following the draft, and it's not something that's new. But when you focus in on that, you lose perspective of all the other things he does, not only good, but very well. He's great at the puck. He's going to score. He's got such a tremendous physical potential. He's very smart. He's going to be able to play a good two-way game. There are so many good things that Sean Couturier can do that I think just that one little flaw in him doesn't erase the fact that he is a safe, projectable guy to play on a first line and be a contributor in both ends of the ice. And that, in my opinion, is a very good reason to take him at number 2.
All right, Corey, I just want to thank you very much for coming on today. I just wanted to find out from you what our readers and listeners can expect from Hockey Prospectus in the coming weeks.
Well, once the draft passes, I'll probably be reviewing each team's selections and basically as many rounds as I can. After that, we're going to be doing detailed organization analysis of each team, so basically top 10 prospects getting reports on every system. And then probably later this summer, we're going to be having our second annual book coming out, which will have detailed statistical analysis and team essays on every NHL team.
Fantastic. Looking to hear more about Ottawa.
Yeah, that's quite the workload. Hopefully make it out of that cloud okay.
Yeah, I'm going to need some help.
Awesome. Well, Corey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. No problem.